wore black denim trousers and motorcycle boots and a black leather jacket with an eagle on the back. He had a hopped-up sickle that took off like a gun. That fool was the terror of Highway 101.
You've tuned in to 96.7 on your FM dial, and this is Hugh Cruzell. The program is QOL, Quality of Life. You know, this program is available Thursdays at 6 o'clock on the station, CKLU 96.7. You can listen through Radio Garden as well. Just rotate the globe, find Canada, find Ontario, find Sudbury, find CKLU. Of course, that's not always convenient for you, 6 o'clock on Thursdays. You can listen asynchronously to podcasts. Just Google my name, Hugh Cruzell. That's K-R-U-Z-E-L, and the word podcast. And there's hundreds of episodes for you to enjoy at your leisure. Today's topic. Well, I do interview authors very, very often. And this one came to me in a slightly unusual way. One of the neighbors said, have you ever read this one? Have you ever met this man? Have you ever seen this cover of this book? Dan Rocheleau, A Gripping Memoir. Now, the title is 1% Hatred. It pops up several times in the book. Let's do the cover first. Why 1% Hatred?
Well, Hugh, it's explained in the book, 1% Hatred. 1% is what the outlaw bikers have crested on their vests. And that means
the front or the back?
It's usually on the front. In a diamond. Mm-hmm. And it's just to let them know that they're the 1% outcast of the public. That's why they...
Or that 1% unique.
Yeah, well, they could be 1% unique, all right.
Yeah, biker gangs.
Yeah, it started way back just outside of San Francisco in a little town called Hollister.
People wear the Hollister garments, yep. Yes.
Exactly. So what happened is that they had the American Motorcycle Association had a rally in Hollister right after the war, the Second World War. And everybody went up and things were pretty quiet. It was just like a hill climb. Things were pretty quiet, so everybody from the San Francisco Chronicle and all the major newspapers thought it was pretty boring. So they set up their own photos and made up their own story that all these outlaw bikers showed up and things were crazy. And they have photos of a guy sitting on a motorcycle with a whole bunch of beer cans and bottles around him. And he looks like he's drunk on the motorcycle.
And so this was created by the media?
Yeah, it was created by the media back then.
And then it grew?
Yeah, it hit the newspaper, it hit the San Francisco Chronicle. And what happened is the American Motorcycle Association put in their own rebuttal to it. And they said 99% of the people that were there were well-behaved, good people, and only 1%.
And they became.
And that's where the 1% came from.
Right.
Yeah.
And so traditionally, motorcyclists wear leather chaps, yep. Whether leather jackets.
Yeah, just for safety, yeah.
Yeah, because you can skid in leather, yep. And that's better. The leather gets damaged than your skin.
Yeah, I always say it's better the sweat than the bleed.
Oh, my goodness. You know about this stuff. Yeah, you know about this, but you know about motorcycles as well. Let's tackle that for just a brief moment.
Yeah, I've been riding motorcycles since 1968, legally since 1976. I was a motorcycle instructor for the police for my last 6 years on the job, and I also rode for our precision motorcycle team, the Golden Helmets for 6 years. Wow. And ever since I retired in 2012, I was recruited to... teach a motorcycle course for Learning Curves in Sudbury here, and I've been doing that since 2012.
I think we have to talk more about this Learning Curves and motorcycle safety in another episode or in print.
Yeah, it's anytime you'd like. Like I said, the safer everybody is out there, the better.
The safer for the motorcyclist as well as anybody around them, or anybody on the bike.
Anybody on the road.
Because it could be, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do... tend to see sometimes people taking chances, both in vehicles and in motorcycles. I mean, there's a lot of raw power there.
Yeah, because you got to remember, you're
going, it's just you on a motor.
It's horsepower to weight ratio, and like I said, motorcycles usually can outdo most cars.
They rock it.
Yeah, exactly.
And do some people put like additional like Fahrenheit 104 in their fuel to give them more?
Oh, I'm sure they do. There's all kinds of things to enhance horsepower on the motorcycle.
Too fast, too furious.
Yeah, turbochargers, motorcycles, all kinds of stuff. Yep.
There's a few people. I did a story on motorcycles. It's an art form to build these motorcycles. Some of them, they're stunning.
Yeah, like you can get them built by any manufacturer, and then you can add on your own stuff, and it just goes on.
Hybridize.
Forever. Yep.
And
exactly.
Be creative in terms of color. They become a palette for your personality.
Yep, exactly.
Lots of skulls though on them, most of them.
Yeah, you can like I said, you can get that on anything for any bike. It's amazing.
Helmets. Just let's touch on that for a moment. Helmets are required now.
Yes,
but
always have been in Ontario.
Yeah, but we don't always see them, do we? And some of them, are they all conforming?
Well, you can get, like I said, it's like anything. You can buy, if you've got a $2 head, buy a $2 helmet, you know. You can get a piece of plastic that'll just sit on your head. That's illegal.
Yes.
And you can buy them at most motorcycle stores. Exactly. Like you get yourself a helmet that's actually going to help you if you do, by chance, fall down and bang your head.
What about your neck as well?
You know? Exactly.
I mean, like, who was it? Unger. Had the neck restraint in his Formula One, not Formula One, it was Daytona 500.
Yeah.
I've often wondered NASCAR. About that. We're going to have to talk more about motorcycles because there's another aspect to it that you've highlighted. Motorcycle gangs.
Yes.
Organized crime.
Yes.
Yeah. What's your connect? And you said police. So obviously this book is about following up on organized crime.
Yep. Yeah, I spent what happens is I would get pulled out of, I used to be in a detachment, and then I got pulled out of a detachment to do special project, and the CIB inspector, I was working.
CIB.
Criminal Investigations Branch.
Right. They're kind of godlike, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they are. They run the OPP, basically. They make all the decisions, all the big decisions, because they investigate all the big cases.
That could be corruption, could
anything.
Be graft.
Yeah, it could be murders, it could be anything along, but they would, anything big, they would investigate, so.
And they would send you?
Yeah, I'd get called, and then I'd go do whatever they wanted me to do in that project, and...
That could mean growing hair and mustaches and looking different and living rough.
Have. Yes, I have multiple driver's licenses, multiple passports, multiple all kinds of things that change identity, haircuts, beards.
Not no haircuts beards. Today for you.
Yeah, I shave it all off every morning now, so I don't have any of that problem. I did grow it back when I used to have to go back to court to Montreal. I would grow my hair and beard.
To
back.
Return to your role?
No, to return to somebody different.
Different. Because, you know, I could see rearranging things. You'd kind of be an everyman. It doesn't take much, right?
Yeah. Well, when you look, there's actually a photo in the book that has a picture of me when I worked in Montreal. And I had a mohawk and a goatee and 7 earrings. And, there was a...
Is that a mullet or a mohawk?
It was a mohawk. Yeah.
Well, maybe mullets weren't popular. Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
And you were you a bigger boy back then?
Yeah, I was, when I came back from Montreal, I was 282 pounds from doing there was a lot of partying, drinking.
Because you had to fit in.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. That's hard.
Yep.
Hard on you, hard on a family.
Yeah, the good thing about that is I wasn't married. So that's why I get picked out all the time by all these different inspectors to... go work these different projects, because they didn't have to worry about me worrying about my family or worrying about, family members or whatever happened at home. So, it was easy.
No, you weren't dragged back because the kid got a bad report card.
Exactly. Or anything.
Or a good report card, hopefully. Role model dad. This program is all about quality of life. And obviously, if you go to Montreal and you... live this role undercover, that's really harsh on a quality of life.
You're like, at the time I was doing a lot of counter surveillance. Every time I would drive anywhere, I'd always be watching. Who was following me, because usually most of the time I was following somebody else.
So there was a tail on a tail.
Exactly.
And who wagged?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So there was a lot of that. And like I said, quality of life is...
Like it was messed up.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun back then when you're young, and you know.
Because you joined very, very like you. Yeah, how old? 18?
21.
You were 21.
Yeah, I was 21 when I come on the job.
I knew that. I just. Yeah. But some people do join even younger.
Yeah, you can back. Well, at one time we used to have a cadet program. Yes. You could join when you were 18.
Yes.
But that only came in sporadically.
To bolster numbers.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
What attracted you originally? I mean, let's face it, one of the things I want to say in doing this interview is thank you for what you do.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Because you keep the rest of us living without worry.
Yeah. My dad thought that the OPP was like the greatest job in the world, and we had six OPP officers.
In your family collection.
No, living on our
street. On our street, That's right.
Yeah, so there was OPP officers everywhere, so my dad thought that would be the greatest job in the world, so.
And you recruited here in Sudbury?
Yes, I did, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, Constable Tappenden. Tall man.
Yeah, Dennis.
Dennis Tappenden.
I worked with Dennis here for years and years.
Gosh, he was the tallest man I knew.
Yeah, he was pretty tall.
Big Adam's apple.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, as a kid, we'd come to the schools and he'd say,
yeah,
you know. Yeah, you know, I don't think he'd point a finger, but he exemplified order.
Yep. Dennis had to be 6'5", 6'6", I think.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, he's a pretty tall man.
Definitely.
Yeah, great guy.
Getting into the old police cruisers wouldn't have been a problem because they were pretty tall.
Yeah.
But today, to get into some of those Chrysler 300s or whatever they are.
Yeah, because... I think because they change the vehicles quite often, like they go to different manufacturers.
Yeah, well, there was a Crown Vicks for a while.
Yeah,
it was really.
Yeah, because I think when I
special version
I started, we had Crown Vicks and Chrysler LeBarons, I think at the time. And then they went to Chevrolet, and then yes. Ford, and I think they're still with Ford now.
Are they?
Yeah.
Going to write a book, a gripping memoir, like. Something must have motivated you to say, I've done all these things. I got to put it on paper. Is that basically what happened?
Yeah, well, it actually happened. I was having a lot of problems. I was having nightmares.
PTSD.
And, yeah, pretty much. And, actually, that's exactly what it was, because our force psychologist had the office right next to our traffic office.
Right.
At the detachment here in Sudbury. And I was talking to him about
this. This is the one on McFarland Lake Road.
Yep, right down the street here.
Yes.
And he come in after I'd done a bunch of different undercover projects. He'd come in and asked if he could borrow me for a few days to revamp the undercover course.
Yes. Because you wanted to make sure, he wanted to make sure, the whole cadre wanted to make sure that people survived their time undercover.
Yeah, exactly.
Successfully.
Yeah, because you can, like I said, you can go bad. Like I said, you spend too much time doing one thing, and then you start justifying it to yourself that that's all right, something good to do. Because while I was doing it, there was unlimited amount of money floating around.
Oh, you get tempted by I'm sure the candy.
I'm sure some people would. Like, I mean, I was brought up...
The boats, the rest of it. When you went to Akwesasne,
yeah.
I mean, do you talk about... The cars, the trucks, I mean...
Yeah, like the money was unlimited there because of the smuggling that went on there.
Cigarettes and
everything.
Drugs.
Booze, cigarettes, people. And everything. I remember sitting there one night on surveillance, parked, and I started to cry, and my partner looked at me and said, "What's wrong?" I pointed down the road, and here come a brand new Lamborghini Countach bouncing off the...
Create some sparks.
Sparks coming off the bottom, and I thought, that's not right. You know, you're taking that car of that beauty and smashing it all from the bottom up.
But if the money is like water,
exactly.
Who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, you have no... But that means also you don't care about people. Is that part of what you were battling against?
Yeah,
is this greed. This inhumanity and... Yeah, greed.
And it all comes down to greed. Hmm. And like I said, we had a 16-year-old... young boys showing us their bank books with $3-4 million in their bank books, and they're 16 years old. Yeah.
It takes a long time as an OPP officer to bank that. Well, never.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A whole bunch of never. Yeah. So that's all it came down to, greed. And that's so much money. It was unbelievable.
So you put your finger in the hole in the dike.
And yep.
You made some of this better. Is today, 2024, better than it was 20 years ago?
Probably not.
So it just continues.
Yeah, it's just like a big giant Amway pyramid, you know, like
guy at the top.
Yeah, you have the with the outlaw bikers. You had a full patch member on the very top, and then you had puppet members on the bottom, and then you filtered right down to the street people who actually sold the drugs for you on the street. Yeah, it's like a big Amway pyramid that.
So the product comes down, and the money goes back up,
floats back up to the top.
We're talking bags of money, hockey bags worth of money.
Yep, I
just for one deal, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I remember having $3.5 million
in the back seat of your car or trunk
in a hockey bag in an airport.
Well, that's better than stinky equipment. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But after I take my stinky equipment out, though, you still have the
stinky bag full of stinky money.
Yeah, and yeah.
Do you think the average person in our communities understand what the OPP does, what the QPP, if that's the correct, Sûreté du Québec,
yeah,
and the RCMP and most other jurisdictions would be parallel organizations doing things provincially, municipally, because some parts of Canada don't have their own police force. Do you think the general public understands the amount of effort it takes to keep our community
safe,
functioning,
yeah,
safe,
basically somewhat safe. Yeah, I know. I don't, like I said, if I didn't know the policing world and I was still a civilian, I'm sure I wouldn't know any of that, like any of that stuff.
How many of these books are out there circulating right now?
I've sold 1,000.
Yep.
I've got 3 left in my car, and all the money that was raised from the book went to children's charity.
Yeah, you meant Camp Quality.
Yeah, yeah. I went $7,000 to Neo Kids
here locally in Sudbury.
And then I thought, well, if your child really gets sick, he goes to Sick Kids in Toronto. So I donated $5,000 there, and there's
all from the proceeds and additional
from the sales of the book. Yeah,
and well, it sounds to me like you probably kicked in some too.
Well, like I said, the books I sell them for $15.
Yeah.
Well,
let's assume that 3 or 4 people read each one of these. Yeah. You've got an audience out there.
Yeah, there was a few sold, and like I said,
not just to your comrades.
Yeah,
this is to people.
Yeah, but like I said, it's true crime. So when people are looking for something to read with true crime, and they were looking for something, you know, like this, they pick that up, because I also, the book is sold on Amazon, and also in any bookstores. You can order it from any bookstore in North America and Europe.
It's self-published, though, is it? Is that
yours?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But okay, let's go back in time. At some point in time, when you were working, did you ever say, I'm going to write a book? There's a book inside me? Or you had to wait to retirement and go, you know what, I need
actually, what happened was, after I'd seen 4 psychologists, and he was telling me that if I was having all these problems.
He said, put it down.
Yeah, he said, just write down all your problems and everything you think about all the time and whatever you went through, and write it all down. And so I had all the notes. And then one night we were out, I was for supper with friends, and one of my friends said, you should write a book. I said, with all that, all those stories.
And you said, sure.
And I started to laugh. Anyway, then COVID hit. And I thought to myself, I had all this time doing nothing. So I thought, maybe I'll...
Well, good things have come out of COVID then. But yeah. I love the chapter titles. I love Chaplow. Like, whoever in their mind is ever going to write a chapter called I Love Chaplow, or, you know, what's another one? Well, that's it. Outlaw Bikers and Other Organized Crime. Well, that's really the, you know, the whole book itself. But where did I... Body language... But I Love Chaplow is just definitely at, you know, really catches your attention. This is a Sudbury book. But it's also an Ontario book and an Eastern Canada book.
Yeah, pretty much, because I've worked in Ontario, Quebec, and New York State. So it's about mostly about those three.
Yep, definitely. And having that border really creates, you know, some weird interactions between our groups. And of course, that whole corner where Ontario, New York, and Quebec meets is like the nexus of craziness, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. Like, if I didn't actually see it and work there,
you wouldn't have believed it.
I would never believe it. As a matter of fact, when I came back,
the boats, the
yeah, everything. When I came back from working there and told some of the uniformed officers that I worked with here what I was doing, I can tell that they thought
you were,
you know, I was just lying.
Yeah.
You know, I was just fabricating all this and making it up. Until you actually work there and find
now,
out.
Now, can we talk about the future? There is some contact between you and a production company to talk about your stories.
Yeah, I was.
Is it okay to talk about that?
Yeah, I'm sure. Nobody told me not to.
Not to? Okay. Yeah.
I was approached by A&E, and they were doing a special on Thursday nights at 10 o'clock called Undercover Caught on Tape. And they did the first season. And when they contacted me, they were in the process of finishing the first season. And then the writer's strike hit.
Yes.
And then there was a hiatus there for a while.
So you're back in discussion.
Yeah. So now they let me know by email about a month ago that if they had to do a second season.
Will you appear on it?
No,
but you're going to guide.
Well, I shouldn't say that because I really don't know how they work it.
Yeah.
They told me that if we do a section of it, I'm going to have to travel down to Los Angeles.
For hardship.
Either Los Angeles or Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, one or the other. And so I said, yeah, no problem. Because I'm not sure what, you know, story they wanted, because there's multiple stories in there.
And there are many there, probably many that aren't even in here.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
For so, reasons and, yes.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, so then we'll see what happens, because I was also asked to send two books to Lionsgate Movies. Down in Los Angeles. I'd signed two books for two producers down there. So
I can just see, you know, you'll be doing interviews like this all over the place, and TV interviews, the spots with you, you'll be famous.
Yeah.
Well, you are famous already.
It's either famous or infamous, I guess. Yeah. So, yeah. So, anyway, I said, made lots of money for Children's Charity with just the book.
It's a brilliant idea.
I'm hoping that if that goes into any type of public.
There'll be more.
Yeah. So, if it goes into a movie or a documentary, it'll be, there'll be hopefully some more money to donate.
That's very kind of you.
Yeah. It's all good.
Huh.
I figure you pay it forward. What goes around comes around, so.
Well, we're only on this planet for a period of time.
Yeah,
you might as well help out. Yeah, definitely. Be kind. So, say 4,000 people have read this. Do people reach out to you and say, hey, Dan, I read it, and wow. Do you get emails from people or messages?
Yeah, I get stuff. Usually a lot of people that have PTSD.
Yes.
I'm getting it from a lot of soldiers and people that have had PTSD from other trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Saying thank you very much for bringing it to the forefront.
Yeah.
So I figure if I can help them.
Well, you attribute some of your survival to an American organization who provided some training for you over time.
Yeah, there was Caliber Press was the name of the company that put that on, and all the segments were called Street Survival. So you get Street Survival 1, Street Survival 2, and it came in different American cities. So I've been to several American cities taking all those courses.
Whew.
Yeah, and a lot of body language courses.
Yes.
Yeah.
How to read.
Read
situations,
yeah,
because there's lots unsaid.
Yeah, it's it could be a help or it could be hindrance, because you're reading people, and so you know when they're lying to you.
Yes.
So it's when you're dealing with really bad people, that's a good thing. But when you're dealing with your family, sort of smile and laugh.
Right, because every family has secrets, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But you don't want to be sarcastic or skeptical.
No,
because some people are just good people.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're just like, you're just getting these little baby fibs, white lies and stuff. That's kind of funny.
Did you ever use a lie detector machine to test?
No.
People? No. But you just do it by your sense.
Yeah. We have special officers and stuff that do that.
Yeah. Psychometrists and various
people who measure names to them. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. In the last few moments, minutes of this program, you know, is there something larger that we need to talk about, you know, that really as a Canadian society we should be tackling right now? I know that our current government is saying build more jails, but really shouldn't the message be to our young people who are coming on the conveyor belt to adulthood that there's better ways to live than being part of organized crime? And this whole, let's go to the opioid crisis too. I mean, how do we deal with drugs? How do we, I mean, maybe it's beyond you and I. I mean, it's certainly, I need a bigger brain if I need to, I need to be smarter to figure out how to deal with some of this stuff. But you've lived it. Is there something you can share with us that says, you know, it can be fixed?
Well, I'm reading and listening to a lot of stuff that's coming out of Amsterdam right now, out of the Netherlands.
Yes.
And they've found that legalizing marijuana.
We've done it.
Hashish.
Yes. Oh, hashish.
And I don't know how far they've gotten on the upper scale on the drugs, but it seems to be helping all those problems, homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, well, if that, you know, that seems to work out
mm-hmm.
over there, that it should be adopted everywhere else. Yeah.
Well, maybe. Portugal has a completely different attitude towards many kinds of street, what we call street drugs. I didn't see very much homelessness or and of course that would be cutting off the flow of cash to some of these organized crime units, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like I said, it's either cut it off or, you know, enhance it. Because like I said, if you just take marijuana, for example, like if you make it better, like the government makes a higher strain of marijuana, I'm sure that, you know, it's like anything. If you bought a bottle of wine and this bottle of wine tasted a lot better than this bottle of wine, you know, you go to the bottle of wine that, you know, was cheaper and more potent.
Hmm.
You know,
maybe.
Yeah,
exactly. Maybe. Wine's a kind of a funny thing. Yeah. Maybe
I'm just using wine as an example. Yeah. But
beer, I mean, people are going for the quality of beer. But marijuana, what do we not know about marijuana? What do we not know about a lot of things? I know at one point the LCBO was going to be the distributor for marijuana, cannabis products in Ontario. Have you ever thought about influencing policy, or is that way beyond...
Yeah, no, you know, after, now that I've retired, I'm really happy retired.
So stay away from some of these things.
So politics and stuff is, I'm trying to stay away.
As we finish up, how many years did you serve?
30.
30 years.
Yeah.
Is that common?
Yeah, there's some guys go with, or guys and girls that leave with less for, you know, multiple reasons. And some stay a little longer just to enhance their...
And they also go into building that knowledge, that corporate knowledge that's out there too, by providing training to younger officers and being mentors.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm.
Yeah, because I lecture at colleges to the Police Foundation's courses and stuff.
In Elmer and...
My last one I did was in North Bay at Canadore College.
Oh, okay, right. So the college is where people take justice, law and justice.
Yeah, our Police Foundation's, all those courses.
Yes,
yeah.
I don't know the proper words for some
of these. Yeah, I did a whole bunch of them at Cambrian College prior to COVID.
Yes.
And it all depends on who the... if you know the lead instructor there, then he knows what you've done. So they'll call you in to do all these, you know, these different lectures. I lecture on.
I wonder if you shared some of your stories with these young pre-recruits. They'd go like, "Oh man, I didn't realize that was that challenging. Wow."
Well, like I said, if you stay in a uniform, that's great. I loved working in uniform.
Yes.
And like I said, they would just pull me out of uniform to go work these undercover courses, and then these undercover cases, and then I would ask to come back to uniform.
It grounded you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, my guest today has been Dan Rocheleau. Dan Rocheleau. My guest today has been Dan Rocheleau. He has a gripping memoir called 1% Hatred. I want to thank Dan for coming today to talk about his book and generally quality of life as being a police officer and the role that policing has in making our total society safer, work better, be consistent, be reliable. Dan Rocheleau, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me here. It was great being here.
And folks, you can tune in this, Thursday, 6 o'clock. You can listen to Radio Garden. You can also listen to podcasts. Just Google my name and the word podcast. Bye for now, folks. And they never found the terror of Highway 101.